athleisure is the term most often used to describe a trend in casual athletic wear that has seen comfortable, technical clothing enter our everyday wardrobes. And as more of us are looking for great pieces to transition from gym to home to office and everywhere in between, demand has created a massive marketplace for new labels with a commitment to strong branding, quality products, and creating a sense of community. Amongst those companies is East London label LNDR, smart, sophisticated pieces for women to wear in the gym or on the high street, launched by Sarah Donnelly, Donna Harris, and Joanna Turner back in 2015. After more than 3 years, the brand is in more than 20 countries and can count Selfridges, Net-a-Porter, and Le Bon Marché in Paris among their stockists. Earlier this year, the label further made a name for itself when it won a trademark suit against Nike to have the abbreviation LDNR pulled from Nike's Nothing Beats a Londoner campaign. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. Today, Donna and Joe are here with Monocle's Tom Edwards to detail their journey to date and speak about plans to also move into menswear.
Let's start off by not talking about what you're doing right now, but going a bit further back. And although it's a bit of a cliche and probably something you've been asked before, I'm always interested to ask people who start their own businesses and are passionate about kind of doing something new, whether they've always been innovators, whether they've always been sort of hungry to do that kind of thing. And I wanted to get a sense from you both, Joe, maybe start with you. Were you one of these people where, as a kid, you know, you were a kind of an ideas person, or has it been more of a slow burn for you?
I don't know. Like, I think probably growing up, I wanted to do a bit of everything, you know, like you go through different periods in your life. Mm. But it wasn't like I wasn't at the age of five, like, I'm going to start my own business or anything like that. I think at school, a few friends and I like started an ice cream business, actually, which lasted a grand total of about 6 weeks during the holidays. I did grow up in a family where business, starting business is sort of the norm. Both my parents and my brother all have their own businesses.
Entrepreneurial stock, if you like.
I don't think they planned that either. I think it's just sort of, I think you are influenced a lot by what happens around you and your family and stuff, but it definitely wasn't something I was growing up with, as in you should definitely start your own business, or they even thought that, or both, you know, my brother and my parents both went into different careers before they started their businesses and stuff. So, yeah, but I think it is always like questioning the norm and looking at things a bit differently is probably, I've probably always been a bit like that.
And I think that's interesting. You know, and we'll, when we reflect on the origin story of the business, I think that's quite interesting, that idea of challenging norms and not necessarily doing things by some grand design, but just having that inquisitiveness. Do you recognise that, Donna, in your experience as well? Or would you say your path's a bit, I don't know, a bit different? Or?
We grew up in Australia. I'm first generation Australian. I think there's nothing stopping you. So you can do anything. I think we got told, you know, you can do anything you want. You can be whatever you want. So you kind of like took that on board and just went along with it. Like moving over here or starting to work, you're always wanting to better yourself and, you know, adapt and move forward. And when you start to do that, you kind of like go, oh, hang on a second, I can do this. And so the more you push yourself and you actually get results or meet people who sort of share the same goals as you, it makes it easier to achieve because it's not unattainable.
With the three of you, was it one of those stories where you'd kind of been waiting for the project to do and you three always had, oh, you know, we should, one day we'll do something, not quite sure? Or was it more that it was this one thing where that brought you together? And was there a flashpoint? I mean, I guess that's the thing, Joe, you know, was there a moment, or was it something, again, was it a bit more organic, I suppose, your particular coming together to get this started?
Yeah, we didn't know each other that well, actually, before the business. I had the initial idea to start a business around this sort of lifestyle, and as sort of my first plan of action, I guess, was to get everyone that I knew in the industry in London together, or everyone that wanted to get their thoughts and ideas on it, on the concept that I had, which was, you know, very loose and not much going for it at the time. And then to see, yeah, I guess from everyone else, I wanted to see what they thought kind of needed changing, like, or what didn't make sense in the current industry. The three of us were already working in the sort of clothing industry, but all in different parts. So I knew Donna and Sarah, three other friends. So I got in touch with them through those friends because I knew that what they did, and they worked in the industry, and that they were willing to come along. from sort of that meeting, I guess, the two of them approached me and said that they'd be interested in coming on board to start this sort of business that we'd been discussing that day. Then it went from there. So then we started further discussions on exactly what the business would look like and what it would, you know, cater to and what products it would do and how it would operate and things like that. And so all those discussions really started from there. All I knew really was that Donna worked for Ted Baker and Sarah worked for Paige Denham, and I knew that they worked in sales, which definitely wasn't my area. You know, I'd heard from a lot of people too that they were good at what they did and blah, blah, blah. And so it wasn't really until we started talking then about the actual business concept of LNDR that we started really working together and the concept really started coming alive.
And Don, let me ask you, because it's always interesting when you talk to entrepreneurs, people set up their businesses and they talk about the learnings from really positive influences. And like, I used to have this brilliant boss and I worked at this fantastic company. Sort of equally interesting is people who say, well, as I was going, I would chart things where I would think, that can't be the best way of doing it. And this is the way that this works. Now, not mentioning any specific businesses. Was your big beginning story with LNDR as much about things you'd seen where you thought there must be a better way as it was about things where you were impressed by how well something worked or how well considered it was?
If anything, it was, I'd learnt so much that it probably gave me a bit more confidence to, you know, when we were in these meetings and you'd start talking and developing, and there were some things you'd be like, okay, these are things that I'm going to take from what I've learnt and grow on them or change them and adapt them. But if anything, I would say that if anything, it gave me more confidence to move into it, because you're like, hey, I do know, you know, what has worked, and the place where I worked was pretty successful. So, and they were really good at training and developing you and making you like a little entrepreneur in your own business. I don't know, I just had a lot of exposure to a lot of parts of the business. And then so being able to come and bring that to our own idea made me really excited. And
that's interesting, because I find that evolution of not just the brand, but the functionality and the form, whatever it might be. What informs that most? I mean, one imagines it's, you know, feedback from your customers. If it is that, there's some nodding happening in the studio. If it is that, how do you do that? Do you literally sort of go and meet people? Do they come to you? Is it just looking at the forums, you know, online, seeing what people say? How do you...
Social is so huge. Right. You know, people are so engaged in social and people want good product. It's amazing how people, when they find something, they will find you and give you that feedback. Mm-hmm. So we'll get emails or we'll, you know, and we'll reach out to them, and we're very close to our customer service, that contact with our customers and also with our accounts that we work with, those other brands that we work with, and getting feedback from their customer quickly and also the buyers. And it's very much with our product, you have to put it on. You have to touch and feel it. The product quality is there, especially in a whole sea of activewear. There is a distinct signature that is LNDR, and people get excited about it. It's amazing how people get excited about it and tell you about that much easier. And I think that's really what we have to do, like ourselves. So Sarah's in front of all of the stores. I'm in front of the customer. And then we all feedback and feedback quite often.
Because one imagines, or certainly, you know, we're quite old-fashioned, I suppose, at Monocle, and we like the bricks and mortar degree of service. You know, the physical product
is
the physical product
too,
is there. The person you're talking to is right there. Yeah. Can you achieve what that can achieve? Can you sort of replicate it if you're selling through online platforms, or whatever? That's a necessity these days. There's very few businesses that can be exclusively bricks and mortar, of course. Yeah. Do you find that a challenge, or is that actually something that, again, LNDR, it works quite well? It works multi-platform. Do you find that's okay?
It has been a challenge for me. Like, my history is, my background is bricks and mortar. I love being on the shop floor. Sarah as well has always been on the shop floor, in the fitting room, talking and getting that feedback really quickly. And so we've just tried to adapt that through customer service and live chat and making sure that our customer gets responded to as soon as possible. Training is huge for us in terms of communicating our brand and communicating what we're about, because it's so much more than just a pair of leggings, you know, that form and function and the thought and the details that Joe's thought of to put in these garments is so huge that it's really important. We have to go and chase it. but it is so different, but something that...
It's definitely a challenge because, like Donna says, like product quality is such a big part of our brand and the feel and, you know, how it feels on, which is a pretty tough thing to communicate through online. So, I mean, it's definitely a challenge and that I think most businesses are facing now is that there's a huge amount of people who are shopping online and, you know, it has its positives and its negatives, but being able to create your brand identity and get all your messages across about the product and stuff.
I guess this question of sort of provenance, the idea that the thoughtfulness has gone into the design, the execution, the materials, the whole holistic sort of preparation of this product. One imagines that you talk about getting feedback. Presumably, Joe, you know, you get a sense that people, sure, they may look a little similar, but people are willing to dig a bit deeper, particularly when it comes to activewear, things that are going to support a particular aspect of their lifestyle, the pursuit of fitness, the health that they care much more about. The noise around that, I guess, is only getting louder and louder. Presumably, you've very much ridden the crest of that wave. People who want to know where you're sourcing your materials, you know, is not just being designed by a production line. It's like they can sort of see the individual hand of the craftsperson kind of thing who's made it. That must sit well with you, that's increasingly a narrative that people are interested in.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Definitely some people are interested in that. I think you still, as a brand, you still need to make sure you're communicating it properly, which is still a challenge, even if you have all those things. If you feel better in it and it looks better and it lasts better and everything, it does make sense, but you've got to communicate all those things about that, and that's just one pair of leggings, you know, so for every single product as well.
So many of the conversations we have here around retail are about that exact thing, not just the personal service, but that idea of the tactility, you know, getting to physically handle something and see and understand why, you know, if it's at a premium price point. Exactly why that is. I'm interested in terms of, you were both talking about, you know, the activewear space and presumably going back to those initial powwows, you know, what are we going to do? The question must have come up, look, you know, this is a market that's still dominated by a number of really, really big players. How early in that conversation did you, I guess, realise that their very size kind of presented you guys with an opportunity because you could focus on a more tailored experience, quality control, more personal? And presumably that remains today a critical, you know, distinguishing point from you and some of those big players. Donna, was that something very early on that you said, look, this can be the advantage, it's not a disadvantage?
I mean, it definitely is hugely important to be different from those brands because there's no point in us coming to the market saying, oh, we're going to, you know, take on Nike, use a better word. But, you know, like, because obviously they're miles ahead of us in so many different areas. So you do have to distinguish yourself from those brands completely, I'd say. And the types of product and the product quality is definitely, and now probably more than ever, is where we really see ourselves distinguishing from those brands. But I think also, like, we went in, the idea initially was very much that it would be activewear that would be as performance as all those brands, and we'd be able to sort of tick all those boxes of performance and being able to stand up to any sort of workout. But then to have an aesthetic that was more contemporary and more, like a European contemporary aesthetic that really suited that whole lifestyle thing, that you could wear it anywhere all day and go to work in it as well, and have that really sort of like clean, pared back, which I don't think any of those brands are doing. And they're the big brands, particularly in the space, are very active focused and lots of, you know, fluoro prints and branding. And there's quite an obvious, I guess, active aesthetic in that way. And we knew from the beginning that our aesthetic would be different because of that aim to be very transitional between contemporary and active, and just like the sort of European pareback clean aesthetic that we think just isn't that common in activewear to start with.
Especially when we launched, everything was print. Every single thing was print. And so it just made it easier to be like, well, it's different and it's a little bit more pared down. And the retailers we were going to, was they definitely had that style that they were selling to their customers. So it just kind of made sense.
Yeah, I don't think paired,
but we never really
paired back has not been used to describe some of those big players that you mentioned. Just on that point, and there were some chuckles around Nike, of course, because you had this very sort of high profile victory, I suppose you've got to call it, about their campaign, where it was a sort of trademark or copyright question about a campaign they'd run that was, well, I guess the ruling was it would confuse consumers and therefore sort of damage your intellectual property and your brand point. Not that many people, I guess, enter into those kinds of battles, and fewer still even are successful. Why was it so important to put a marker down? This is your baby, the three of you. Was it a simple question that you felt, sort of wronged in some way? Or did you want to protect exactly that messaging we've been talking about with your consumers, hard fought territory you'd stake to claim to?
Yeah.
Why did you decide it was so important to,
It was definitely from a damaging point of view. Like, we knew pretty instantly how damaging it could be for the brand, which, I mean, definitely was not an easy decision, although we made it or had to make it quite quickly. None of us obviously have ever been in any situation. I don't think I'd ever talked to a lawyer outside a pub before.
No.
And, and it ended up, it was a pretty, huge thing for us for a good 6 months or so.
3 years trading and take on Nike, sure.
But, I think, really our thoughts behind it were, at best, it would, really lose, brand distinctiveness for us in our market. And probably at worst, people would see our brand and just assume that our products or our branding were Nikes or Nikes. It sort of, we came to that realization, I guess, quite quickly, although it got stronger. We flagged it with our lawyers when it was just a couple of people wearing T-shirts. And after we, started, sent them a cease and desist and things and started the process, then they released the entire campaign, with that video and everything. So it obviously got the feelings or the awareness about how damaging it could be for us just got worse and worse.
I think, and people just texting us out of the blue saying, "Is this you guys? Is this you guys?" And you're just like, "What?" We've been working so hard to build this premium, elevated brand.
I suppose, much as they say that imitation is the highest form of flattery, that doesn't really wash when you've staked so much, personally in a project. What was the response that you got from your fans of the brand, maybe some new converts who arrived as a consequence, and from people you'd been working with already? I imagine they must have been were they encouraging? Did they say, "You guys must be crazy"? And then obviously when it was successful, did people sort of share your joy? It feels like a real win for this kind of smaller player in a way.
I mean, we tried not to speak about it too much. Obviously, we don't want to give it any more. It's not completely over yet, before the ruling by the judge. Obviously, we sort of didn't want to give it any more exposure than they had already got from it. But so we didn't talk to our customers and things about it. But as far as the wider audience or friends, I mean, most of the advice you got at the beginning was this is a bit crazy. Usually with these sorts of things, the people with the most money always win. And you can imagine if it comes down to that, where we don't compete. I think the truth of the matter was that we owned the trademarks. They knew we owned them. In some ways, I guess we had the law on our side, but it doesn't make it an easy decision and doesn't make it cheap to do. And we were lucky enough to have external help to do that. And I think the reality is that a lot of brands wouldn't, and they wouldn't be able to protect their brand even with owning the trademark.
So it's a bit of a lesson for,
I think,
if you're starting something out, make sure you're covered and you're trademarked.
You also do need to then get the funds to back it up in the instance. Although, you've got to think this is a relatively rare circumstance. And I think when you get your trademark initially, you think you're protecting yourself from new startups, using the same brand as you. You don't consider that the biggest apparel brand in the world might start using it. So, that's a lesson that I didn't think I'd have to learn this early on. But
let's talk a bit more then about the sort of the big ambitions here and looking to the future, which I think it's always a compelling story to hear from people. Even, the company's still relatively so young, but so much achieved so quickly. Maybe, do you need to be mindful of that and sort of, not have expansion plans too quickly and balance up? I'm sure you get lots of sort of approaches about things, where next, what new product lines and all the rest of it. Is that a balancing act, I suppose, first of all?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've big ambitions, and sometimes, you know, you fall short a bit, and you definitely do things, you know, stretch a bit too far and realize that, you know, maybe that was a bit too much, a bit too soon. But in the end, I think you've got to do it, and you learn from that, and then you come back a bit, and then you go further. So, you know, I think we've always wanted from the beginning, we wanted to grow something, you know, quite big, quite quickly with whatever we had to do that. So I think, like, we didn't want to just grow something very organically, bit by bit. So you got to take those risks. And, you know, I think the plan is to, you know, to be able to really grow a brand that can be accessible to enough people to be globally successful, and not be, like, we're not trying to be too niche or too premium either. So we do want it to be like a large scale business, and we're relatively impatient about that happening. But, you know, like,
menswear, we've got menswear coming through.
Well, I did want to specifically ask about that, because I'd seen, obviously, you guys mentioned that before in passing. I was intrigued just personally to know what that might look like, because it's interesting that it's a space where, in the sort of menswear realm as well, there's a few players in the marketplace, but there's certainly room for a bold new entrant, no?
Yeah, definitely. I think the other part about it is menswear is still very different to women's wear, and
particularly the premium active space is really young for men's. Like, in women's, there's just so many premium activewear brands. Like, women are used to, like, they're kind of pre-educated, I guess, in, like, the fact that there's the big active players, but then there's all these, like, premium sort of more fashion orientated active players now, and they're used to going to those fashion stores to find those active brands and whatever. The guys are still generally, for the most part, they're still, you know, the Adidas's and the Under Armour's and the Nikes.
It's kind of like they either wear street or they're wearing performance and go to brands that they're used to, or their girlfriend or their whatever, you know.
So it's a bit of an education piece as well, like, or kind of teaching guys that this is, like, you know, that there is that active wear that's transitional to everyday contemporary wear as well. You know, we're launching the first range in November, but it would definitely be, you know, a test and learn process, and getting that message across to men, like we were talking about, like, getting the message across online to women also. It will be just as hard, if not harder, getting that across to guys. But I'm sure the whole thing will be different, and we'll just have to see how it goes and what we learn and how we have to evolve that as we go forward.
Bold plans, big plans, ambitious plans. As the business becomes bigger, as the global footprint grows, are you confident that the very qualities, the nimbleness of being a little bit of a smaller player, that personal touch, getting, you know, on the shop floor, meeting people, all this kind of thing, are you confident that's, I mean, obviously that's, I guess it's more difficult to do that the more places you are. Is that all about investing in, still this back to this point you made about investing in people, and is that going to be the secret to ensuring that you retain all those qualities that are more associated with the smaller player as you get bigger?
I think so. It's definitely really about the people that you bring on board, and it really still has to be driven by the three of us constantly in every area. And so where we will grow in, you know, America is a huge territory for us and something that we are going to be investing and moving to build our brand. And that means one of us have to be the one to go and do that and to bring people on who just have the same values as what we do. We're all the things. Everybody gets in, does, you know, the job, and we, you know, we're not too big for our boots to be able to be the ones doing that first and showing that. So it's very much about developing and bringing people on with their same values and hopefully scattering them out and checking in with them. And
I think always, just, I guess, going back to the point of, is what you're asking really is how we scale to make sure that we still have that sort of care and attention to detail. I think, you know, I think it is a massive part of our business to have that test and learn process and making sure that we're sort of going in the right direction and doing things sort of because they make sense, not because, you know, we read in a book or we experienced before in a larger company that, you know, this is the right way to do it. So that's very much part of our ethos as a brand and a leadership team as well. that we consider all those things from a really logical point of view. So I think it will be as we grow and hopefully we stay true to it, but we keep checking in and making sure that it still makes sense to the brand, to what's really important to us. And I think from the beginning, the product quality and the details, and I mean, I think to any business now, the service, customer service is huge. So you let that slip, then, you know, you'll probably realize pretty quickly that you're going in the wrong direction. But it's sort of just having those metrics in place and those processes in place to make sure that we're always checking back in and measuring to make sure that we're not losing sight of the important parts that helped us get to where we are in the first place.
I did want to ask, and we should of course predicate this by saying once again that Sarah isn't in the studio with us. Yeah. What about the three of you? We sort of heard the sort of origin story right at the start. And what about your kind of day-to-day working relationship? Is it, do you still sort of do things by kind of committee? Do you all have to get out of the office together and go where it's quiet and your phones aren't ringing every 5 seconds? How does it work between the three pillars of the business?
We definitely have to leave the office
to get focused more than anything, but to focus to think about outside the day-to-day. Yeah. You know, there's six of us in the leadership team that will run the different sort of areas of each business. And then, yeah, the three of us still catch up. We're not as much as we should probably, but I think that something just with the recent growth of the last year or so probably has slipped a bit. But yeah, I think that'll definitely be important moving forward. It's just all too easy, I guess, like to, as the business grows, you just seem to get busier and busier. Mm-hmm. And it's just something like your day-to-day just becomes, you know, more of your day.
Is it collegiate? You know, do you have a good chat, or do you occasionally need to have a bit of a dust up to sort of battle through? You know, there's a lot of stuff to cut through. Time is scarce, as you say. Can you sometimes get some creative things when it's a bit more sparky?
We're not particularly sparky with each other, I don't think. No. But it's also, I think it helps that our sort of areas of expertise are quite different. Mm. So like these guys don't question me too much on the creative side, and I don't, you know, like we discuss it a lot and we talk a lot about, because it's all got to work together, you know. If something's not selling or the customer's feedback from it or whatever, then that feedback always has to be, there has to be a really close feedback loop constantly. But it, I think, it's still very clear where the expertise and the skills lie. And so it's having that process of communication and feedback, and then sort of letting the person sort of really own the bit that they're good at. So I think, like, I'm never going to come over and take over sales and and be like, I think you should be selling like this. Yeah. But you know, so I think that's really crucial and what helps it probably be less sparky, because we really trust the skill set that everyone has.
Other, I think, is at the end of the day, we all three of us want the same thing.
And that's all the time we have for on today's show. Thank you to Donna Harris and Joanna Turner for sharing the story of LNDR. Thanks as well to Tom Edwards for the interview and to Stephanie Sakia for research help. This show was co-produced and mixed by Kieran Matthew Banerjee. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.